Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors. We go into all kinds of situations with expectations. They're shaped by our previous life experiences, or by stories we hear, movies we see. But a lot of times, those expectations set us up for disappointment. Because real life usually isn't like the movies, especially when it comes to relationships. Today's episode is about expectations gone awry. It's a story about a young woman named Paula Davis, who went to Alaska to work with sled dogs. She'd always been good with dogs, and she had a sort of storybook vision for what her Alaskan life would be like. It was a vision involving close-knit, loving relationships with the dogs she'd be working with. But falling in love, whether with people or with animals, doesn't always work the way we think it should. And sometimes, our expectations hold us back. I'll let Paula take it from here.
The first dog our family had was named Moosh. Moosh was a mutt. Her mom was a yellow lab, and her dad was a short, fat beagle. My parents were young newlyweds, living in New Jersey, and they were supposed to be buying a car. But there was an ad for puppies misplaced in the car section of the classifieds, so they ended up with a dog instead of a car. When I was born, Moosh was 4. She protested my arrival by eating a potted plant in the living room, but after that, we were good. Moosh and I were pretty much inseparable. We played together, we napped on the floor together, we went on walks together. She was my first friend. When I was 10, Moosh had to be put to sleep. Moosh's death was the first death that really hit me. I cried and wallowed and looked at old pictures of her. Our family had lost a member, and I'd lost a friend. A few years later, we got Duchess, a black lab. She ushered my brother and me through our teenage years. And after Duchess was Meg, a terrified rescue dog from New Mexico. I was always close with the dogs in our family. Moosh slept next to my bed. Duchess and I went for long hikes, just the two of us. When we brought Meg home and she was too scared to leave the front hall, I was the one who stayed with her. I wrote stories about dogs at school. I cried in movies if the dog died. For a while, I wanted to be a vet, and then I started fainting at the sight of blood, so I stopped wanting to be a vet. But still, I saw myself as a dog person. My mom would call me the dog whisperer, and I would roll my eyes and feign embarrassment, but I was proud. Dogs were something I was good at. So when I finished college and my best friend went to the Yukon to work with sled dogs, I thought, I can do that. I decided to follow her lead, to move to Alaska for my own winter with sled dogs. I researched Alaska. I emailed people in variously vacant parts of the state, asked about their dogs and their towns. I looked up their addresses and scrolled over huge swaths of white land and tiny snow-covered trees on Google Earth. I wrote lists and ran online forums. Eventually, I found someone to work for, a couple, in a place called Talkeetna. Their names were Jerry and Kathleen. I saw Talkeetna on the map, partway between Anchorage and Fairbanks. It had one main street, 3 bars, and was 65 miles from the nearest traffic light. When we talked on the phone, Kathleen told me I'd live in a cabin on their property and help with taking care of and training the dogs. Kathleen and Jerry seemed unperturbed by my lack of experience working with sled dogs. They asked if I could handle the cold, the dark, the solitude. I assured them I could. American culture loves to capture the deep, beautiful bond that can exist between humans and dogs. As a kid, I watched it over and over in Homeward Bound. I read it in Where the Red Fern Grows. There are those classic images. The boy and his dog, looking meaningfully into one another's eyes. Human and dog, crouched side by side, staring into the distance. A dog licking a kid's face. As I busied myself with ordering new warm clothes and buying plane tickets to Alaska, these images filled my head. This is what my new Alaskan dog sledding life would be like. Adventures with my canine best friends. Companionship and meaningful eye contact. Non-stop dog kisses. When I got to Talkeetna, I was told that my first task was to learn the names of each of the 80 dogs. When we walked through the yard that first morning, Kathleen told me who was who as she gave them their morning kibble. Most of their boxy plywood houses had names painted on them, but some dogs had been switched from one house to another, if they'd been eating rocks or humping other dogs. Nala was actually in Athena's house, Bumblebee in the house that said Pepper. Ale's house had no name. He'd eaten the piece of wood it was painted on. Kathleen carried a 5-gallon bucket of kibble, and I followed like a child, listening intently, too self-conscious to ask many questions. The yard itself was large and haphazard, a clearing surrounded by tall, skinny birch trees, filled with dogs and dog houses. The houses looked like they'd been rolled like dice into the clearing, just left wherever they landed. As Kathleen and I zigzagged between them, the dogs seemed almost not to notice us. It was odd, walking through a yard full of dogs, not stopping to pet a single one. I had to resist the urge to kneel down next to each dog, to give them a good ear rub, a kiss on the head, to say hello and make eye contact. Well, maybe I'll have time for that later, I thought. The reason I had been hired, the reason Jerry and Kathleen had 80 dogs in the first place, is that Jerry was an Iditarod racer. By the time I showed up in Alaska, he and his dogs had run the Iditarod 9 times, and I'd been hired to help prepare for his 10th. The Iditarod is an enormous undertaking. It's a 1,000-mile-long dog sled race through the coldest part of the continent at the coldest time of year, with a trail that isn't really marked, and where it is, the markers are often blown away by storms or covered by snowdrifts. Teams of dogs and their drivers, called mushers, race from Anchorage to Nome, over rivers, mountains, lakes, on their own the whole way. At checkpoints along the course, they can pick up drop bags that they've sent ahead, big sacks full of food and extra supplies. Sometimes, after dinner at Jerry and Kathleen's house, Jerry would put on an Iditarod documentary. There's one made for literally every year's race. We'd watch the mushers and their dogs come in and out of checkpoints, their breath visible in the negative 30, negative 40 degree weather, facial hair covered in ice. They'd talk about the trail conditions, the weather, the health of their dogs. The dogs were all business. They looked either ready to run, standing at attention on the line, or asleep, curled up on little piles of straw, their tails tucked over their noses to keep them warm. In other shots, we'd watch mushers and their dogs progressing along the trail. The dogs were so perfectly paced and methodical as they ran, eyes forward, trotting along. Occasionally, I'd catch a glimpse of a musher patting a dog's head, maybe a quick ear scratch. But mostly, there was no evidence of the kind of dog friendships that I had known and loved as a kid. The winter clothing I'd mailed ahead for myself hadn't arrived in Talkeetna by the time I had. So those first couple weeks, I clomped around in borrowed gear, a giant jacket, boots that were 3 sizes too big. I slowly learned the ropes of my new life, my new job. I did finally learn the names of all 80 dogs. It helped that each litter was named for a theme. There were R2-D2, C-3PO, Luke, Leia, Obi-Wan, Darth Vader, and Yoda, Megatron, Optimus Prime, and Bumblebee, Goose, Maverick, and Iceman, Ale, Guinness, and IPA. I learned how to use an axe to chop frozen fish carcasses apart, to make a huge pot of boiling fish carcass stew for the dogs. It was the only way to ensure they drank water, since it tasted like fish and wouldn't immediately freeze. I learned who got which kind of kibble, the race dogs, the retired dogs, the puppies, and I started to learn the dogs, their personalities. Who was always amped? Who was calm? Who was mischievous? It felt good, getting to know them a bit, but I still didn't feel like I'd made any breakthroughs with them. When I arrived in Talkeetna, there wasn't enough snow on the ground to take the dogs on actual sled runs yet. So we would hook them up to a line tied to the front of an ATV and drive through the woods while they pulled. I learned how to put a harness on a dog. I learned that Obi-Wan made that process nearly impossible, barking and twisting and jumping, and that Mickey would stand perfectly still and calm while I put his harness on. I learned to say gee and haw, the dog sledding commands for right and left. And I learned that the lead dogs would, usually, actually follow those commands. I was learning to do my job, but I wasn't bonding with the dogs like I had expected to. Nothing about dogs was like dogs in my life to that point. These weren't companions. They were working dogs. It didn't matter if they knew sit, stay, and shake. They needed to know how to run and pull for hours at a time, and how to eat everything put in front of them. My cherished memories of Moosh are of the two of us falling asleep side by side on the hardwood floor in a sunbeam. I certainly wasn't making any memories like that with these dogs. Maybe it would happen eventually, but I felt myself beginning to let go of those hopes. When I wasn't with the dogs or my bosses, I was usually hanging out with a couple I'd become friends with, Sarah and Derek. They had a 1-year-old husky named Uller, named after the Norse god of snow. I liked spending time with Sarah and Derek, but I especially liked spending time with Uller. Uller was familiar. He was a pet, like Moosh or Duchess or Meg. He snuggled on the couch, he knew sit and stay and lay down. When I stayed over, he slept on the bed at my feet, keeping my toes warm. What I couldn't get from the 80 dogs I spent most of every day with, I could get small doses of from Uller. I often thought of Uller during my hours in the dog yard. If only I was working with a team of 80 Ullers. When we finally had enough snow to start running teams on sleds, Kathleen taught me how. She told me the most important thing about driving a dog sled was to never let go of the sled. Never. Dog sledding looks easy enough. I'd watched so much of it in those Iditarod videos, I figured, no problem. All you have to do is stand on the back of the sled and get pulled by a bunch of dogs. But of course, it's harder than it looks. The first disconcerting realization I had while on the back of a sled being pulled by a bunch of dogs is realizing that they could take you wherever they wanted. Yeah, they're well-trained. Yeah, they know these trails, but standing on the back of an aluminum sled as they pull you, it's impossible to not realize how small you are compared to their collective strength. I understood now what Jerry had said as we watched the Iditarod documentaries about trust between dogs and mushers, about literally having your lives in each other's hands. Kathleen had warned me that I would probably fall off the sled at some point, and about halfway through my first run, as we were going down a hill, I did. But I kept my grip on the sled. The dogs kept running, pulling me through the snow until I was able to grab the snow hook, like a dog sled emergency brake, and finally pull the sled to a stop. I did eventually get good enough at driving the sled to not fall, but my dog runs were not without incident. I once ran the sled into a tree, coming around a tight curve at the bottom of a hill. After crashing the sled, my immediate concern was the dogs. I went down the line, checking each one, talking to them and apologizing and reassuring them. They seemed startled, but fine. It wasn't until we were already heading down the trail again that I realized I'd bent the runner of the sled. I knew I'd get chewed out for damaging the sled when I got back, but I spent the rest of that run watching the dogs and just feeling so impressed by them. I'd run cross country in high school, played soccer in college. I considered myself a good athlete. But the smooth, fast, consistent pace these dogs kept while pulling me and my sled for hours at a time, it really was amazing. They were incredible athletes. During the Iditarod, they would run an average of 100 miles a day for 9 or 10 days in a row. It was an awe-inspiring thing to consider.
Hey, it's Willow. We'll get back to the story in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Support for Out There comes from Dish Outdoors, makers of the Tailgater Pro portable satellite antenna. The Tailgater Pro makes it possible to stay up to date on what's happening in the world while you're off on adventures. For many of us, summer is a time to head outdoors. Maybe you hit the road in a van or RV. Maybe you soak up the sun from the deck of a boat. Maybe you hide out in a cabin in the woods. Regardless, just because you're off the grid doesn't mean you have to miss out on the news or your favorite shows. Dish Tailgater Pro is a portable satellite antenna that lets you watch the things you love anywhere. It's rugged, weatherproof, and weighs just 8 pounds, so you can haul it around or mount it on top of your boat or RV and just forget about it. It doesn't need Wi-Fi to operate, you don't need to be a Dish subscriber at home to get Dish Outdoors, and you only pay for the months you use. Visit dishoutdoors.com to learn more and use the promo code PRO50 at checkout to get $50 off your Tailgater Pro and Dish Receiver bundle. That's dishoutdoors.com, promo code PRO50, and of course we have a link to that on our website. And now, back to the story.
As the Iditarod got closer, there were more tasks, more chores, more dog runs. Jerry started taking his race dogs out on longer training runs. And while some were out on the sled with Jerry, others needed to be hooked up to what Jerry and Kathleen called the wheel. It was like a dog carousel, a big horizontal wheel parallel to the ground. We'd hook 8 dogs to the wheel at a time, and they'd run, pulling it in circles. Once they'd settled into a good pace, the dogs would run on the wheel for up to 4 hours at a time. It was just another job I had. Feed the dogs, water the dogs, scoop the poop, get Jerry's sled ready, then get the other race dogs on the wheel. I'd meander the yard, doing chores and listening to NPR while the dogs on the wheel ran and ran. A few days before Christmas, I woke to find a note scribbled on the back of an envelope in the shop, next to the dog food. Kathleen had written to let me know I should get 8 dogs on the wheel, followed by another 8 after that. She'd written out their names below. The note said that Jerry had gone to Anchorage for the day, so he wouldn't be running any teams. I turned on the radio, pointed it out into the dog yard, and started my chores. I scooped poop, and then I got the first set of dogs going on the wheel. They started running, and I settled into some other chores. I knocked snow off the roofs of their houses. I rolled dog booties into sets of 4 to send along with Jerry to the Iditarod. I was inside the shop when I heard barking. Barking was something I'd gotten used to in all its variations. When a dog was loose and running through the yard, it sounded one way. When a moose came too close to the edge of the yard, it sounded another way. When I came out to feed breakfast in the morning, yet another way. This barking was different. When I stepped out the door and looked at the wheel, the first thing I noticed was a chain that no longer had a dog at the end of it. There was just a collar, dragging along the snow and bouncing over the ridges in the ground. The chain next to that did still have a dog attached, but it wasn't running, just dragging, being pulled by its neck as the other 6 dogs barked and ran and spun the wheel. I hit the brake and stopped the wheel. I realized Michaela must have wiggled out of her collar. She was bounding around between the other doghouses. But Maverick was limp, still attached by his collar to his chain, but completely unmoving. This was my nightmare. To have another person's dog die on my watch. To have any dog die on my watch. I ran to Maverick's side and put my ear to his chest, an idiotic move given the chorus of barking and howling still going on around me. I pressed on his chest, in a loose approximation of CPR, and attempted to deliver rescue breaths. I ran to the house to find Kathleen, but it turned out that at the last minute, she decided to go with Jerry to Anchorage. They were gone for the day, Christmas shopping. So I went back to Maverick. To my relief, he was showing signs of life, twitching, moving his paws, trying to stand, but not quite succeeding. I carried Maverick into the shed and sat by him for the rest of the day. Eventually, he started to perk up. He stood up and slowly teetered around the shop, bumping into buckets and bags of food. Because there was no vet in Talkeetna, I called an EMT I'd met at the bar, a friend of Jerry and Kathleen's, and she came to sit with Maverick and me in the shop. Her best guess was that he'd had a seizure and then lost consciousness from being dragged by the wheel. Her presence comforted us both, Maverick, as he slowly moved around, and me, as I came down from my adrenaline panic. Eventually, she went home, and I stayed with Maverick until well past dinner time, just watching him, talking to him, petting him, hugging him and crying, and wiping my tears on his fur. Like a person reeling from a car accident, the next few days I felt the need to move slowly and carefully. Things seemed too bright and too loud. Instead of moving quickly from task to task, I would stand silent for a moment after each chore, watching Jerry and his team disappear into the trees, or just taking in the sounds of the dog yard around me. It wasn't that Maverick's accident had changed anything in any kind of concrete way, but it did change the way I thought about the dogs. I realized I hadn't understood the relationship I had with them until now. I didn't think I'd had any special kind of bond with the sled dogs, because the only kind of bond I'd ever had with a dog was the kind I'd had with Moosh. Moosh and I were friends, companions, and the sled dogs and I weren't that. But we were something. We were more like co-workers, more like teammates. We might not cuddle with each other, but we did have to count on each other, and trust each other, and take care of each other. I had spent so much time focusing on what these dogs weren't that I hadn't realized what they were, what they meant to me, and what we meant to each other. When the Iditarod finally came, I was ready for my Alaskan adventure to be over. I had started making plans with friends back home for when I returned. I was daydreaming about wearing shorts. But as we brought Jerry's sled and 16 dogs to the start line, I felt the magnitude of what they were about to do. 16 dogs and one man, outside, in Alaska, for 1,000 miles. As our start time approached, I found myself kneeling in the snow, telling Goose and Charger to listen to Jerry and to be alert. I was telling Jazz and Witwicky to use their energy for pulling, not fighting. I was hugging IPA. I hadn't planned to get emotional and whisper last tidbits of advice, but there on a frozen lake at the start of the Iditarod, I sort of felt like the dogs could understand me. When the announcer finished the countdown, Jerry and the team took off, running between two long lines of bundled, cheering spectators. As I watched them disappear into the woods across the lake, I felt a warm, rising pride. I was proud of us, of Jerry and Kathleen, of the dogs. I'd gone to Alaska with one idea of what a dog-human relationship could look like, and I didn't find it there. It wasn't Lassie or Air Bud or Wishbone, but while the dogs in Alaska and I hadn't watched movies together on the couch, we had traversed hundreds of miles together over all our runs. While we never slept side by side in that sunbeam on the floor, we'd come to understand each other. I fed them, kept their houses clean and warm, and they never led me astray on our runs. Of course we'd formed a relationship. It was just different. Now, back in Colorado 7 years later, I have a dog of my own, a rescue mutt from somewhere in Texas. She's the kind of dog I grew up with, the kind of dog who curls up on the couch with me and naps in the sun. And I love that about her. It's familiar and comfortable. But I think about the sled dogs from Alaska often, and when I do, I remember them with fondness, not regret. I even named my own dog after one of them. Working dogs aren't pets. But my relationship with those 80 dogs in Alaska taught me something important. Sometimes you have to embrace a relationship for what it is, rather than trying to turn it into what you expected. Sometimes you have to be open to a different kind of love.
That was Paula Davis. She and her dog Goose live in Denver, Colorado. When she's not making audio, Paula works to help educators buy homes. Special thanks to House of Pod, a podcast co-working space, production company, and education center in Denver. House of Pod graciously agreed to record Paula's story for us, so please give them some love if you're in the area. And if you're looking to make a podcast of your own and you're in the Denver area, check them out for sure. If you like what you hear on Out There, please consider supporting the show with a financial contribution. For as little as $1 a month, you can do your part to help us create the stories you hear on this podcast. Our stories typically take months to put together, literally months. And we would love to be compensated for the work we put into them. Out There is a full-time job for me, but it certainly is not a full-time paycheck. I'm doing it because I love it, but I do also have to pay the bills. Your support in any amount helps a lot. To make a gift, just go to outtherepodcast.com and click support. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking, and our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.